Well, every guitar enthusiast listening to Current State is loving the sounds of that here on our Live Music Friday presentation. That's Lansing's Drew Howard, who is our Live Music Friday special guest here today. Drew has played on the program several times as a member of one musical configuration or another, but he steps out of the shadows today and is alone in the spotlight. More live music from Drew, and we'll have a little conversation about playing with Bo Diddley and John Sinclair and Tom Paxton and all kinds of people here before the hour is through. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. There's some new movement in the fight against HIV infection. A team of Michigan State University researchers has helped to identify a protein that appears to stop the virus from replicating. Now, it's doubtful the term endoplasmic reticulum class 1 will ever be the household terms that HIV and AIDS have become over the last 30 years, but that protein may one day be a part of clinical trials that might lead to a cure. At the same time, the World Health Organization has released new guidelines for the prevention and treatment of HIV. Here to talk about these advances is Dr. Yonghui Zheng. He's an associate professor with the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at MSU, and he's part of the team that helped discover the protein. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Todd Haywood, an HIV activist and journalist here in the Lansing area. Todd, welcome back.
Good morning.
Dr. Zheng, we want to help a lot of non-scientists listening to understand what it is you've discovered. So let's try to keep this as simple as we can. The physical structure of the HIV-1 virus is fundamental to understanding this discovery. It has a protective skin around it, known as, you call it an envelope. And the envelope is the key element here that allows the virus to infect a host. Do I have that right?
A little bit different. So the virus has an envelope, and on top of the envelope, there's a protein called envelope glycoproteins. These are the proteins are very critical for the virus to infect cells.
Okay, and tell us about what you've discovered here.
Okay, so we identified this ERMAIN1 protein. Indeed, it was discovered by accident. So around 10 years ago, we selected a number of human T cells for HIV infection. Surprisingly enough, we found a particular cell line which is highly resistant to HIV infection. We spent a great deal of effort to understand why HIV cannot infect this cell line. So to make the story short, when we tested how HIV proteins were produced in these cells, we found one protein was missing. This protein is called viral envelope glycoprotein, which is localized on the surface of the virus and helps the virus to penetrate into cells and start an infection. How the envelope glycoprotein disappears in these cells was a mystery. Until last year, we discovered that ERMAN1 caused the degradation of this viral protein.
So ERMAN1 is the name of the protein?
Yes, we call it ERMAN1, correct.
ERMAN1, and it is by and large an accidental kind of discovery?
Yes, because we accidentally found HIV-resistant cell lines, and by understanding the mechanism, we found out this protein. So from the point of view, from the procedure of this discovery, I can't call it by accident.
Todd, you are HIV positive. You've done a lot of research on this topic, and I mean, to a large extent, you are living this. What's your reaction to the news that Dr. Zheng and his team may have discovered something truly significant here in East Lansing?
Well, I think, and I need to actually get a clarification here. Doctor, is this cell line an elite controller cell line?
It's not. But, you know, the cell line we start to work with is a T cells. So the T cells are primary targets for HIV infection. So we cannot establish such cell lines from elite controllers. So that is a difficulty we have right now.
Okay.
It might help our listeners here to
sure.
follow this. If Todd, you appear to understand what an elite controller cell
right.
line is. We were going to get to that eventually in the interview.
Right.
Explain what that is.
Elite controllers are a specific group of people who are infected with HIV who naturally keep the virus at bay. Their immune system doesn't seem to be impacted by it. So with the information that I now have, this is actually pretty exciting information in terms of identifying new routes towards mm-hmm. drugs and targets. We've always known that this virus is really crafty at shifting and genetically modifying itself to be resistant to drugs that we have available. You know, we've got seven classes of drugs available right now. What this discovery does is it opens an avenue towards something that's always there for the virus, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have that GP120 point on the virus in order to bond to the CD4 cell to infect it or mm-hmm. the T cell. So by having that target and knowing a weakness, that allows us to look at possible drug treatments, which is really exciting. Now, the bad news is that science is very slow. So we're probably looking at 10 or 15 years before we see a human.
What about the timeline, Dr. Zhang? Do you feel are you in general agreement with that? Are we looking at maybe a real breakthrough another decade down the road?
Les, I totally agree with Todd. So I think from the WC discovery and to the real drug development, there's a bridge. So right now we just open a direction, and we need to further to investigate how to make this target become a translational, drug, and how to treat HIV infection. So I think there's a time requirement there.
We're talking about recent advances in the field of HIV research, specifically the MSU team that is part of a group that's identified a protein that seems to prevent the HIV virus from replicating. Our guests are Dr. Yonghui Zheng, an associate professor with the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at MSU. Also with us today, Todd Haywood, a local journalist and HIV activist. You are encouraged by this here. I'm not sure you really finished the original question that I asked you here a couple of minutes ago.
Sure.
In broader terms, what do you make of this discovery?
Well, this is great. I mean, here's the reality. This virus has been around for 30 years, and it's a really crafty virus. Mm-hmm. So finding things like this where it's a universal weakness for the virus mm-hmm. is great for treatment options and decisions and ideas. So we have gotten to a point now, I think in the last probably 15 years or so, where we're really identifying new weaknesses in this virus that we just didn't have the science for the first 15 years of the epidemic to do it mm-hmm. with. So it's exciting.
This week, the World Health Organization issued new guidelines for preventing and treating HIV. One key recommendation is the daily use of something called PrEP. I have that right?
We've talked about that.
PrEP, and we have talked about this on your previous visit on the program, I believe. Pre-exposure prophylaxis. Remind our listeners what PrEP is and why it's important.
Sure. PrEP is the use of one of the antiretroviral drugs. It's actually a combination of two drugs, but it's one drug and a pill, called Truvada, mm-hmm. and that's the only one that's been approved by the FDA in the U.S., that has been found to be a minimum of 92% effective in preventing somebody who is HIV negative from getting infected with HIV if they take it daily. Now, the math models from NIH show that it will be 99% effective in preventing transmission. That's incredibly exciting. That is better than vaccines.
Now that you have identified this protein, Dr. Zhang, where is the future? Where are the next, are the coming months and years for you and your lab on this topic?
So I think the first thing we are interested to understand is the relevance of this protein in natural HIV resistance. So we are interested to know whether there is any correlation between the level of ERBM1 expression and the viral loads. We are expecting to see some kind of result, like the higher ERBM1, the lower viral loads, which could suggest that this protein plays a role during natural HIV resistance.
Are there other undiscovered proteins or molecular components waiting to be discovered like ERBM1?
I totally believe so. Yeah, ERBM1 could be a one, not the final. So I think we are all interested to develop more.
There's an ongoing study that originated in Europe, Todd Haywood, that's focusing on the impact HIV treatment has on reducing the risk of HIV transmission. It's called the PARTNER study.
Right.
Tell us about that.
That study has found, and they've studied thousands and thousands and thousands of partners and sex acts between them where one partner is positive and one is negative. And what they have found is that a person who is on successful treatment, and that's defined as somebody who takes their pills every day and has an undetectable viral load, which is a measure of amount of virus in your blood, is very unlikely to transmit the virus. Now, I have to use very unlikely to transmit the virus because that's the technical term. We always have to have the little leeway to play. But the reality is they've found zero cases of transmission of a person that's virally suppressed to a person who is HIV positive. Not one.
I'm going to wind you up with a question with a limited amount of time. I apologize in advance for that.
Sure.
But in 2015, I want to hear from both of you. How seriously does HIV threaten public health? Dr. Zhang?
I think currently 1.2 million people are infected with HIV in the United States. And in China, in 2014, 104,000 new cases are identified.
Over 100,000 in
right.
China.
In China only.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
Todd, what do you think? In 2015, where are we?
It remains a huge crisis. And in fact, it continues to disproportionately in the U.S. impact men who have sex with men. And that's a topic that we just don't talk about in public health right now. And it's a real crisis. Mm.
A sprawling topic. Hopefully we've shed a little bit more light on it here today. We've been talking about HIV research and new treatment guidelines issued by the World Health Organization. Thanks to our two guests. Todd Haywood is a journalist and HIV activist here in the Lansing area. Also, thank you to Dr. Young Hui Zheng, an associate professor with the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at Michigan State. Thanks to both of you for being
thank
here
you.
Today.
Rings where the angels sing, a voice so pure and so fair, and if you look to the heart of a friend, you'll find her name. I'm all alone since the call of fate left me in the deepest despair. And if you wait at the pearly gate, you'll find her name. Alone, alone sits that marble stone. Left me in the deepest despair. And if you look in that heavenly book, you find her name.
You'll find her there, That is Drew Howard, probably Lansing's best-known Travis picker. They're displaying his chops here on Current State's Live Music Friday. Bill Monroe song, you'll find her there. More from Drew Howard before the hour is through on a Live Music Friday here on Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. So how many times have you planned a little winter getaway vacation and when it was over you came back home having gained a few pounds? Well, now that it's getting colder, we all know that birds like to take winter trips, but they bulk up a bit before they travel. Current State's Kevin Lavery took a little trip to the woods to learn more. So, Kevin, gaining a little weight is actually a good thing for a bird?
It actually is. Mark, birds need to build up their fat reserves to have the energy for that incredibly long migration south. Most birds in Michigan fly to the tropics. The Kirtland's warbler, for example, has standing reservations in the Bahamas. So I went out to Bath Township yesterday to learn how the experts track all kinds of frequent flyers. The Burke Lake Bird Banding Station in Bath Township is certainly out of the way. I've had to park across the road, and I have to follow the signs into the woods, so hopefully I can find the place. Morning.
Morning.
How are you guys?
My name is Zach Polin, and I work at Burke Lake Banding Station as the bander. This is my third year here.
Band number should be 09, is that correct?
09, yep.
So what we have here is a golden crowned kinglet, and right now I'm putting the band on the bird, making sure that it's completely flush. This guy is going to have this band for the rest of his life, so we want it to look good on there. And one of the first things I look at on a golden crown kinglet is its crown. What we're looking for is for orange to be concealed under the yellow coloration on the crown. And as you can see on this guy, by blowing, there's extensive orange underneath that yellow. What we can know from that is this is a boy. This is a male. Females will not have that orange. And unlike a lot of birds, these guys are very easy to tell the differences between males and females.
I'm Jen Owen. I'm associate professor in fisheries and wildlife and the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences.
You're holding a very tiny bird in your hands,
yes.
Jen.
This is a winter wren. So this is one of the birds that comes later in the fall. We just started catching them within the last week. So this is one of the smallest birds that we're actually catching. They're actually a little bit of a challenge because they get into our mist nets and they like to do a little bit of acrobats in there. But they are definitely a very cute bird.
And it's a nice, like a chestnut brown color. And
yes.
It has, almost reminds me of pheasant tail feathers.
Oh, right, from the barring. So this is definitely something you'll see in wrens. And that is the dark coloration of this wren and the small size is kind of what distinguishes it from other wrens. Like the house wren is a larger, still brown, but lighter color, whereas the winter wren is really this deep, dark brown, chestnut brown.
Right now it's fall, the start of fall, the migration period is mm-hmm. happening for many different species. What does banding really tell us about the life cycle of a bird and where it travels or how old it is?
What banding gives us that's different than, say, just going out in the woods and spotting a bird with your binoculars and recording it is that by handling the bird, one, we get to look at its condition, the amount of fat that it has on it, its amount of muscle stores, how much it weighs. These are very important attributes of a successful migration. So a bird that is able to put on fat, it's very important for them to be able to then fly and make that migration south.
Are you just warming it up by blowing on it?
Actually, I blow on it to part the feathers, and this is how we collect the data on a lot of things like fat and muscle. Once you part these feathers, you can look at fat, muscle, you can look for ticks, and it's just the easiest way to kind of survey these birds for the data we collect.
And you can see fat and muscle in the fraction of a second it takes to blow on the bird.
Yes, when you ban thousands of birds a year, you get a little routine going where comes a little quicker then.
Wow.
We use a scale for fat which goes from 0 to 6. This means that when we look at a bird and look at the extent of the fat stores, we're looking in kind of the throat region and the abdomen. 0 would be 0 fat, no fat. A six, which we don't get here, would be essentially a complete sheet of fat all the way over its keel. And so when Zach's blowing on those feathers, he's looking to see the extent of that fat, and then he scores it with the 0 to 6 score.
I have a fat scale in my bathroom. I do not like looking at it. I do not like recording data on it.
We make birds feel good about being fat here. We like fat birds.
Comes in handy at Thanksgiving, too.
Yes.
My name is Callie Gismundo, and I'm the site coordinator for Brick Lake Banning Station, and this is my third fall working here.
You're holding a very noisy bird. What is this?
So this is a Swainson's thrush, and it's one of our more common caught thrushes here at the station. It's also one of the farther migrants, so it's going to go all the way to Central America, South America.
He does not like being held.
I think he's okay, honestly. He's just noisy. Every individual sometimes has little quirks, and this one just seems to be really loud for some reason. I'm sure he'll fly away fine. He'll be okay.
Halfway through this interview, we came across the find of the day, maybe even the whole year.
This is an adult female rusty blackbird, and when we're banding these guys, some of the things that we look for is the coloration, the amount of rusty on their head, the coloration of their underwings, and like most blackbirds, the measurements of their wings. 50.3 is the mass.
And this bird is truly a canary in the coal mine. This bird gives us some information about its ecosystem.
It does, and I think it's great the amount of effort that a lot of organizations are putting into documenting rusty blackbirds throughout migration.
You found a rusty blackbird. Those are incredibly rare.
They are, and this is a bird, a species, that we feel incredibly privileged to be able to capture. Previously, the station only operated until September 30th, but now that we're running into October, when rusties are starting to migrate, we are starting to catch them. And we also have our nets in habitat that is perfect for rusty blackbirds. So yeah, it is a privilege to be able to capture a species that is experiencing such significant declines and sort of help with documenting and banding individuals, because that is really important for the conservation, is to just get a better understanding of birds, rusties during their migration and numbers, so forth.
Dr. Jen Owen is an associate professor in the MSU Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. Jen, thanks for the opportunity today.
It was great to have you out here, Kevin, on this beautiful fall migration day.
Callie Gismundo, thank you, Callie.
Thank you very much.
And Zach Poland.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
So now a little postscript to this story. I've learned over the years as a reporter to pay attention to what happens in the first few minutes after you've turned off the recorder. As I was in my car driving away from Brook Lake, I looked over and I saw in a field two large sandhill cranes having a conversation. For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
Lansing guitarist, singer Drew Howard, our featured performer here on WKAR's Current State on our Live Music Friday. We have live music coming to you from Studio S virtually every Friday here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's homecoming weekend at Michigan State. This year's homecoming parade grand marshal is Flint native Bill Brohn. In addition to leading the floats and the bands, Bill Brohn will be sharing his musical wisdom with MSU College of Music students through the weekend. The 1955 MSU alumnus has made a career arranging and orchestrating for some of Broadway's and Hollywood's biggest shows, including Miss Saigon, Ragtime, and Wicked. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Bill Brohn at the Kellogg Center yesterday to talk about recent projects and recollections of his student days at the College of Music.
I remember we had a performance from England. I think it was the Royal Shakespeare Company doing the complete Midsummer Night Dream with the entire score of Felix Mendelssohn, with a symphony orchestra, which they brought with them. I heard Isaac Stern play a solo recital there.
By the time you graduated, 1855, that was the first year. It was called, I'm sorry, 1955.
You're closer.
The year that you graduated was 1955, yeah. The centenary year. What do you remember about that, your graduation year and that milestone at MSU when you were here?
There was a good deal of celebration, and I was honored to be asked. At that point, I was a would-be conductor. I'd studied conducting with faculty at the music school, and I was asked to get together an orchestra and get together music to play for one of the big celebration banquets, and that was stood out more in memory because I had colleagues, of course, from the school playing in this very little orchestra, but we were able to play for the president and John Hanna and all of the board and the many, many guests.
You've arranged for so many London West End and Broadway shows with very familiar names, everything from Rodgers and Hammerstein to more recent performances like the musical Wicked. I want to recall a program that Lansing area audiences recently enjoyed. That was a production of the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. What did your experience bring to this production, and how does something like this evolve or adapt from the original opera, Porgy and Bess?
The original Porgy and Bess, the opera, is certainly one of the outstanding works of American music that everybody alludes to as a historic great and a breakthrough. With its all African American cast and its indisputably gorgeous Gershwin score. However, it's still called an opera, and it is not a musical. Diane Paulus, who is the artistic director of the ART, American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had the idea that there is a musical, more of a true musical buried somewhere in Porgy and Bess. It's over 4.5 hours long, if uncut. So that required a lot of adjusting and a lot of adding some elements like an overture, which it never had. It had a curtain raiser.
I'm very interested in talking to you as somebody with a classical music background and from a radio station that has classical music as an important part of its format, about your work with the restoration of the film Alexander Nevsky, creating a restored version of this Sergei Eisenstein and Prokofiev 1930s masterpiece. This was, from what I've read about this, just an incredible knot to try and untie, including recreating a high-quality soundtrack to this restored film image with limited access to scores and a jumping-off point of an original soundtrack that was very primitive. And you said, Prokofiev's music is complicated to begin with, but the quality of the soundtrack made it more difficult. Can you talk about that process of
yes,
recreating this?
Yes, certainly. John Goberman was the producer. He called me in. The reason it was so difficult is that his assignment was, we want the entire score as it was edited ultimately and dubbed into the Eisenstein film. It has dropouts in places, and some places you cannot even identify the instruments. All of this is in an optical track, which is a combined track with the audio, the voices
right,
speaking. So it's a job of excavation.
Yes.
I had to sit in front of that very poor copy. It was done just before the war began, Second World War, and a very primitive recording equipment. We had to make it work.
How did you feel about the end result, the whole piece?
Thrilled. And more than thrilled when Leon Gregorian and Dean Forger brought it here. For it's, incidentally, that was its first ever university-licensed performance of it, of the score with the film at Wharton Center.
Allô, musique!
Among your many professional and musical achievements, are you adding Grand Marshal of a parade for the first time?
Indeed, the first time of any serious involvement, even tangentially with football. I'm a music nerd.
Arranger, composer, conductor Bill Brone. Bill, thanks for taking the time to be on WKR today.
Peter, delighted to be here. Hi to all Spartans and their families and friends.
For WKAR, this is Peter Wolf.
Drew Howard, our Live Music Friday special guest here on Current State's Live Music Friday. This is Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. Current State also comes your way every weekday at noon on AM 870 WKAR, and we're always at WKAR.org. Halloween decorations have been on store shelves for weeks now, but maybe you have the urge to go a little farther this year. An event on Saturday in Lansing is designed to inspire a do-it-yourself approach to Halloween entertaining, and Current State Scott Pohl is here with a look at what you'll see at How to Halloween. So fake spiders and plastic vampire teeth just aren't enough for some people, are they?
That's right, Mark. You know, with as much or as little effort as you like, you can make your Halloween display stand out for your trick-or-treaters and party guests. There will be lots to see at the Lansing Center tomorrow. The Lansing Entertainment and Public Facilities Authority, LEPFA, is putting How to Halloween on with Robot Pumpkin. That's the brainchild of Lansing area neighbors Steve Sneed and Jerry Judlowski. Steve Sneed says they've both loved Halloween all their lives.
Jerry and I have shared stories about how when we were growing up, we built costumes with our mothers and our parents, I still remember that, you know, going out and building a robot costume with my mother and just thinking how cool it was. Well, I lived out in the country for 11 years, and we had a kid, moved into Hazlitt, into a neighborhood, and we thought, you know, why don't we try and build something for Halloween? And out in the country for 11 years, we didn't have a single trick-or-treater. And I came back here, and it's all set. We built this cool display for that first year, and I was off and running. So I guess that notion, that love of Halloween, kind of went dormant for a bit, but now it's all I talk about. So,
well, you know, for the kids, the houses they remember are two different kinds. One is the house that gives away the big candy bars, and the other is the house that has the big elaborate display that you can tell took a lot of work, and that's where you guys fit in, right?
I think I try to be both of that for the house, definitely, that they want to come back more and more. And that was the nice thing, living across the street from Steve, you know, we just attracted the kids, and you know, we'd have hundreds of kids and trying to outdo each other each year for bigger and better, badder displays, and we'd have kind of a friendly rivalry across the street, and it grew from there. So, but yeah, we really like to make it a nice experience for them, almost turning this block into a mini amusement park theme attraction place to go for the day, and they love it. Yeah,
we're talking with Jerry Judlowski and Steve Sneed about How to Halloween. It's a big event at the Lansing Center on Saturday. And Steve, we are standing in your garage, and part of what we're here to see today are elements of what you had on display here at your house
last Halloween, and we're going to do that because people can see it at the Lansing Center on Saturday. Tell me about the basics of what the setup is going to be.
Certainly. We basically set this up so that the kids can play the game during the trick-or-treat. And I dress up as a farmer, and I try to get these kids to help me send these aliens that have invaded my farm back up into the spacecraft. So what will happen is we have some pneumatic targets that pop up, so little air targets. So these are actually real targets that appear in 3D, real space. It's not on a computer screen. And the kids can shoot at them with guns from an old Wii game console. And that's just using air to move back and forth. We also have another component, a really cool spacecraft that Jerry has created. It looks like a 1950s Area 51 UFO. And I'll let him talk about how it was actually built. But it's that thing will descend from my garage ceiling down to the floor. Kids, the aliens will pop up. Kids have to shoot them. And then the aliens get back on the spacecraft and head back up into space. So that's kind of the idea. The game takes about 30 seconds. And the whole idea is to give the kids something different to do when they trick-or-treat and get them in quickly, have a cool experience, and then send them on their way.
Tell me about this UFO you've built.
So this is part of the game that Steve's come up with is the Green Invaders from the Red Planet. And part of putting these displays together is trying to do it on a budget also. So imagine what they are two patio umbrellas that I've painted silver with silver spray paint and sandwiched them together. I ordered this white acrylic dome to go on top, and we've got some blinky lights and strobes, and with it synced with sound effects, it really makes a great effect for the kids that when they come up synced with the gameplay, it's kind of a good way to start things off as it dramatically comes down from the ceiling and lands for the beginning of the game, and as they go to shoot aliens and give them a good experience. Yeah.
Well, we're going to post some pictures of things at WKAR.org so people can get a taste for what we're talking about here. But I'd like to fire up the game. What's the game sound like, Steve?
Okay, I'm happy to fire it up. I'm running it on a laptop, and the laptop basically controls everything and displays some video and the score. So right now we have kind of a cinematic 1950s type of movie trailer or poster, I guess you could say. It says Green Invaders and the Red Planet. You can hear some of the old sci-fi cool music playing. And this will play when the kids are coming up to my driveway.
And it's projected on the front of your garage.
Exactly. So this is basically designed to entice them. Oh, keep in mind too, I also have I'm in a band, and I have a big stereo system where I'm just blasting this across the neighborhood. So once we have all the kids ready to go and they're ready to play, I do my little spiel about, hey, I need you to help me send these alien invaders back to their planet. Then we start the game up. And at this point, there's some video playing from some old, sci-fi flicks of UFOs going across the screen, and Jerry's UFO will actually descend from the ceiling. So once that little bit is done, then the gameplay starts. The aliens will pop up via pneumatic actuators, and the kids can start shooting at them. Each gun has its own unique identifier, so I know who's shooting what alien.
And we're seeing a bit of a scoreboard there, so kids can keep track of who's
exactly. So then once the gameplay is done, there's a newspaper that spins in and has the daily news and says local kids have sent the aliens back to their planet, and it gives you a score.
Great fun. I want to hear some of the pneumatics involved in making these alien heads pop up too. How does that work?
The way that works is we have an air compressor. It uses air to move targets up and down. So we've got a air compressor. It's a standard air compressor you can buy at Home Depot. It routes into the circuit board that I built with some engineering friends of mine. And what it allows me to do is use my computer to direct air out certain channels. And it's kind of a Frankenstein contraption, but you can see there's a bunch of air hoses that are coming from it. I can control air from the compressor, two different channels. Those air hoses, those channels, go to pneumatic actuators, which are basically pistons, air pistons. So if I, on my computer, I say, send air to piston number one, piston number one will extend and it will pop the target up and the kids will shoot at it.
Cool. Our guests on Current State are Steve Sneed and Jerry Jodlowski. They are the co-founders of Robot Pumpkin, and they're instrumental in the big How to Halloween event Saturday at the Lansing Center. Jerry, I think the timing of this is great because of the growth of Maker Studios, and Make Magazine is popular. There's a Maker Studio at places like the East Lansing Public Library. Do-it-yourselfers and people who want to tear apart electronics and see what they can do with that stuff, it's just a growing trend in America these days, and How to Halloween on Saturday is another way to get some exposure on how to do some stuff like this yourself.
That's exactly right. It's kind of a way to promote creativity and innovation and invention and to try something out, all wrapped up in the fun package of Halloween that appeals to such a broad audience. You know, there's groups like the Lansing Makers Network that do an absolutely amazing job of promoting this sort of thing. And even Impression 5 Science Center, how many things you can learn from them and their projects that they promote. And they're all going to be here at this event. It's wrapped up in a nice entertainment package where it can appeal to the haunt fans. You have the sci-fi group and the comic book fans and the pop culture and the family fun, something for kids, and we've got a lot of live music too. So the spectacle is huge, with a little bit of something for everyone.
Jerry Jodlowski is a co-founder of Robot Pumpkin. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate you having us.
The other co-founder is Steve Sneed. Thanks for welcoming me to your garage today.
Thanks for coming out, Scott. You're welcome at any time. I'll give you a circular saw or hammer. I'll put you to work.
That's maybe not a good idea. How to Halloween is 11 to 5 at the Lansing Center on Saturday. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And it's a live music Friday here on WKAR's Current State. Live from Studio S all this hour, we have been enjoying the sounds of Drew Howard. Drew's a longtime Lansing guitarist and singer and songwriter. Right now we're going to hear an original song of Drew's called My Waking Dream.
Thank you very much.
I can see you. Your face is so familiar and your hair is waving in the breeze. Is it true that we were once together? Are you waiting? Are you just a dream? Don't disturb my waking dream. Don't disturb. I'll join with you directly by myself, lost among the treetops, deep inside my waking dream. I was gathering the wool among the clouds where my memories, they come a golden thing. Is it true we can travel time and places never visited and people never seen? Don't disturb my waking dream. Don't disturb. I'll join with you directly by myself, lost among the treetops, deep inside my waking dream.
Drew Howard. It's called My Waking Dream. Drew's live in Studio S here on Current State's Live Music Friday on WKAR. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
I think you've been here more often than any other single performer we've
really?
Had, just because you're a part of so many different kind of ensembles.
Yes.
Yeah, but this is your first time solo. You juggle a lot of regular live performing with teaching. Do you like that dynamic? Would you perform full-time if you could? How does that play out?
I like the variety. I mean, it's, you know, I would be tremendously bored if I did the same one thing all the time. And that includes performing, although I do like the whole process of performing, throwing my gear in the car, starting it up and rolling down the road. And so I'm lucky that it's different, even with teaching or with gigs.
We got less time to talk than I was hoping we would have. I'm sorry about that, but we appreciate your coming in here today.
Pleasure.
When are you performing live in the Lansing area next?
I'll be performing next Thursday at Moriarty's with the Hopening Quartet. Then I'll be playing October 18th and the following Sunday. Those are two Sundays at the East Lansing Farmers Market and then also at the Allen Marketplace.
Very good. And you've got a website so people can catch up on that. Just drewhoward.com.
Drewhoward.com, yes, sir.
We're going to have you play us out here, Drew. I was just handed something that I'm going to read verbatim. And it reads, WKAR won the NAB 2015 Marconi Award. Best non-commercial radio station in America. I can hardly believe I'm reading that, but it was just handed to me 2 minutes ago, and that is quite an honor, and it's a hell of a way to wrap up a work week, I'll tell you that. We'll learn more here once we leave the air. Coming up Monday on Current State, while Congress continues to argue over funding for Planned Parenthood, the debate over abortion rights is playing out here in Michigan. We will have two special guests who will debate the issue here on Monday. Drew Hill plays us out. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again Monday here on Current State.